I'm going to ask you to turn in your scriptures tonight with me to the book of Job, chapter 29. This is all we're going to look at is one chapter, Job 29. We are quickly coming towards the final chapters in the book. And if you're like me, you're wondering, do I even understand the book yet? I've read several pastors who have asked the question, why in the world would I want to preach on the book of Job? In fact, one preacher said he announced it, we're going to start preaching through the book of Job, and several people met him at the door saying, what are you thinking? Don't do that. And he said, I think it's going to be good. And when he got done, he had grown immensely. So many things he didn't know, pleasantly surprised along the way. And I would say that that is the case in my life and testimony. And I hope that in some way that you could say that it is also the testimony of yours. Typically, most people look at the prologue, the first two chapters, and the last couple of chapters and call it good. And we leave all these other things in the dark. There are so many riches and gems there that I'm actually convinced myself and committed to a lifetime of study in the book of Job. I call my good friend Tim Sigler, who's our missionary, who travels in Israel and is teaching now in North Carolina. He did his PhD on the wisdom literature in the Bible, so Psalms, Proverbs, Job's, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. And we spent several conversations talking about the book and what it means and what we can learn from it, making good observations and rehearsing things along the way. So I'm going to read Job chapter 29, and then I'll pray, and then we're going to do some foundation lane. This is in Job's monologue, which goes from 28 all the way through 31. Job further continued his discourse and said, in 29, verse 2, oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and when by his light I walked through darkness. Just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were around me, my steps were bathed with cream, butter in other words, and the rock poured out rivers of oil for me. When I went out to the gate by the city, when I took my seat in the open square, the young men saw me and hid. The aged arose and stood. The princes refrained from talking and put their hands on their mouth. The voice of the noble was hushed, and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouth. When the ear heard it, then it blessed me, and when the eye saw it, it approved me. Because, here's the reason, because I delivered the poor who cried out. The fatherless and the one who had no helper, the blessing of the perishing man, came upon me. In other words, he worked in the medical profession of sorts. He helped those who were dying one way or another. I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness and it clothed me. You ought to just write that on your refrigerator. What a great verse. I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind. I was feet to the lame. I was the father to the poor. And I searched out the case that I did not know. I broke the fangs of the wicked and plucked the victim from his teeth. And then I said, I shall die in my nest. And he's talking about like a bird who's all snuggled away and happy, has everything he needs for the winter. 18, then I shall die in my nest and multiply my days as the sand. My root is spread out to the waters, and the dew lies all night on my branch. My glory is fresh within me, and my bow is renewed on my hand. Men listened to me and waited, and kept silent for my counsel. After my words, they did not speak again, and my speech settled on them as dew. They waited for me as for the rain. They opened their mouth wide as the spring rain. If I mocked at them, they did not believe it. And the light of my countenance, they did not cast down. I chose the way for them and sat as chief. So I dwelt as a king in the army, as one who comforts mourners. That was back then. Chapter 30 is what's happening now. Let's pray, though. Lord, thank you for the opportunity to meet here tonight. And as we reflect on how you're nourishing our souls through thinking about suffering and how we should defend you and honor your name even when we don't understand the importance of trusting you no matter what, being able to say that though he slay me, yet will I trust him, and responding like Job, shall we receive good from the hand of the Lord and not receive evil? There is a sovereign, mysterious grace about what you do. And you have not promised us a rose garden in this life. You've not promised that you are a machine. We put in a few tokens and we get good back out. But you have promised that you care for us and observe us, and that ultimately you will defend and vindicate those who love you, those who walk with you. And we can begin to see the faith of Job. We've seen it in other circumstances, and we see it again here tonight, that he's more than just a person trying to do good works to gain eternal life, that he is a person who has an intimate relationship with you. As he looks back on his life, he's beginning to realize, his eyes are seeing that everything he had was simply the blessing of God. It was undeserved. It was the favor of God who was his friend, who cared for him. And though he doesn't understand why he is where he is now, he knows why he was where he was before. It's all because of you. So encourage us tonight through this text. I pray that the book of Job will become a friend to all of us. We will begin to understand it. And as over the years of our lives, we read through the scriptures, if we struggle through a point here or there along the way, that the overview will begin to draw us closer into a deepened relationship with you. So thank you tonight for the time we have. Thank you for Jesus, and it's his name we ask. Amen. The book of Job is our study here tonight. I've got a couple of pictures up there on the board so that you can be reminded of who we're looking at. As I was discussing with you earlier about why we ought to study the book of Job, many people have attempted to explain it, and so I was reading from Christopher Ashe from Tyndale House. He would be in the UK. It's a very scholarly and a great place. If you ever read anything from them, it's going to be very good. And he gave seven reasons why we ought to study the book of Job. He said, number one, to understand God for who he is. This is one of those books that just scratches away from the surface, scratches the scales off of our eyes, or blows the dust off of our scriptures, and we begin to see God maybe in a way that we haven't seen him in any other location. Number two, we learn to grapple with God's sovereignty, that clearly this is one of the underlying messages that go through the whole book, that God can do whatever he wishes to do, and whatever he wishes to do is both right and good, even when we don't understand it. And if it comes down to I either need to defend myself or defend God, I need to defend him every time, because he's going to be more right than I am. Thirdly, it rejects false gospels. And the false gospel that we've seen is the gospel of the three friends. The gospel of the three friends is simply this: if you do good, God will bless you. If you're bad, he won't. It's works righteousness. It's law. It's whatever you want to refer to, the difference between law and grace. And essentially, the three friends are law, and Job, as he answers back to them, is grace. And so all kinds of false gospels it refutes. Number four, it helps us to identify with those who are sufferers. His three friends were terrible at being counselors, and yet we're like other people who were probably sitting around the campfire. We haven't seen them or talked about them, but just as you look in the New Testament, when Jesus came to have a dinner, there would be the guest and those who were the people that put it on, and all of the crowd would sit around the outside. The same thing would be true for the book of Job. And so here's Job sitting down there, and he's scraping his back with the potsherd, whatever, and then the three friends are there, and there's Eliphaz who's sitting over here, and there would have been everybody else listening along the way. And each one of them, they might have looked at Eliphaz and say, you're miserable at helping Job, or maybe you're good. But it helps us as an observer to also identify with those who suffer. It helps us to find hope in the midst of pain, because this all turns out for the good. You know mostly about that one. It helps you to develop your emotional palate. And by this, what I mean is we're kind of stoic Americans. We don't really know how to express ourselves. We don't like poetry. And we don't put things in flowery language. But there are better ways and glorious ways, excuse me, to say things that are wonderful. Pardon me. And number seven, it is an encounter with the living God. That's where we're moving to. Towards the end of the book, we're going to be looking at a storm theophany. And it's probably already brewing. And so a storm theophany is as the circle of friends are sitting here and the crowd is outside of them, the wind is beginning to blow and their hair is starting to go up on end and their robes are starting to go sideways because clearly there's something coming over the horizon and it might have been off the lake or some other way and it's a tornado or a hurricane as we're dealing in the hurricane season. And the storm, as it gets louder and louder and louder, you begin to think and realize this is not a natural storm. This is God. And many times in the Old Testament, God shows up in a whirlwind, in a storm, and they want him to feel his presence. And by the time God is there, they almost have to shout as they are talking to one another because the awesomeness of his presence is so great. And so those are things that we can learn as we look at this book. What the book of Job teaches, five or six things that I just sat down and wrote out all of myself. Number one, how to be a faithful sufferer. You need to be a faithful sufferer. We're all going to go through trials and difficulties, but I need to keep trusting in God. Job did very well in chapter 2, and then he kind of fell off the wagon, and it was this slow process of catching up with the wagon that was still going on. Before the end of the book, he's back up in the driver's seat. And in fact, I want to say that by 29, he's got a hold of the reins. That Wells Fargo wagon and those horses have been running away, and he's been dragging on the back like you could see in the cowboy movies, and he's now back over the thing, and he's holding onto the reins because he's coming up with some really good conclusions in the chapter that we just read. Number two, how not to be a miserable counselor. Don't be like those other guys. They were awful. They were judgmental. They thought that they knew God. And the thing that we said about the three friends that is so, I think, helpful to remember is almost nothing that they said was wrong. It was all incomplete. And you can tell lies with a partial truth. And so they knew a few things about God or something about God. And because of what they knew about God, they thought they knew everything that God was doing. And their truth, their partial truth, ended up being an attack on Job rather than a blessing. Number three, how to speak well of God in our trials. And by this, let me stop and catch your attention if I can so you don't think I'm just wandering on here. When I was talking about this point and the next point with Tim the other day, I says, you know, if you look at a study Bible of the book of Job, everywhere in the Bible, they reference Job. Job is important to the scriptures. And I was telling him that it casts a shadow over the rest of the scriptures and it teaches us how to worship God and how to speak well of him in our trials and difficulties. Two of the poems, one by Eliphaz and one by Job, are just absolutely phenomenal. And they're used in Isaiah, they're used in Psalms, they're used in Proverbs all over the place. Clearly, these two points here teach us how to praise God in ways we never could have done so before. It teaches us that a relationship with God is not based on good works. So you know that, right? We need to be reminded of that. Even as Christians, I can begin to think that my relationship with God is based on good works, and it's not. And so we ought to do good works. It is faith alone that saves, but faith that saves is never alone. And I need to do those works, but it's not why he loves me, and it's not why he blesses me, and it's not why he's good to me. It's based on faith, not on works. It teaches us, the book of Job teaches us, that we are welcome to express our grief and to express our sorrow, as in Job chapter 3. It was a down chapter, you know. I didn't really look forward to it when it was there, and I wasn't very happy when I was done with it, because it's a challenging place to be. But we're welcome to do those things. And by the way, when Job falls off the wagon in Job chapter 3, that's as low as he gets, and he does come out of it. And we're already seeing that he has. He's a different man than he was way back in chapter 3, that you could grow in the middle of your suffering. And in fact, I guess that's just the point that I'm really making. Even though Job had not sinned the way his friends had accused him of sinning, he needed to grow. and he does grow. And God uses suffering in his life to grow him in tremendous ways, and he's still got at least one more way that he's going to grow before we get to the end of the section. So with that, we're going to learn in all of those things that God's grace is mysterious. Okay, God always acts righteously even when we don't understand. And the last point that I've already said this, but you should see it again one more time. If it comes down to defending myself or defending God, I should always defend him. Just defend him. He's right. He's good. I don't understand what's going on. And in fact, we're going to hear this twice towards the end of the book. It's going to be made abundantly clear that Job justified himself rather than justified God. He wasn't defending God. He should have been defending God. And instead of defending God, he was defending his righteousness. And he got in trouble for that. And he's going to answer for that and learn something from that before it's done. Just so you can understand and think through it, you know this already. If you look at the book of Job, you're going to say, oh, I know. There are three cycles in the book of Job. The first cycle, Eliphaz and Job, and Bildad and Job, and Zophar and Job. The second cycle is, lo and behold, Eliphaz and Job, and Bildad and Job, and Zophar and Job. Guess what the third cycle is? It is Eliphaz and Job, and Bildad and Job. And Zophar doesn't bother to talk. And the reason he doesn't bother to talk is in this section right here, or maybe this one right here, I'm sorry, this one right here, Job is so convincing in his argument against what they have to say that he proves them wrong and silences his critics. He uses example after example and reminds us that evil people do sometimes do quite well in this life. There are the Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and the Rockefellers, and you could think of lists of people that seem like they're happy all the way until their grave, till the end of time. And with those demonstrations, works righteousness of Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar is really put to silence. So what does it do in the book? So here we go. I love to do these kinds of things. I think that they're as helpful as anything. I'm going to give you some words, five words that can help you. If you want to write anything down, I think this will do it. There is prologue in chapters 1 and in chapter 2. It's the prologue of a godly man. It's the setting of the stage of the rest of the book. And so that's why it's frustrating that people often look at Job 1 and 2 and then close the book on it. It'd be like reading the introduction to a book and say, wasn't that a great book? And then go on and read the next book. We don't want to do that. Then there's the dialogue. So you go from prologue to dialogue. And the dialogue goes from chapters 3 all the way to 27, the three friends and Job, back and forth. And in the occurrences, Job's friends get shorter and shorter, and Job's answers get longer and longer, so shorter and longer along the way. So you have the prologue and the dialogue, and I wonder what would come next. It would be the monologue. See how this is helpful? And so we look at the prologue, we look at the dialogue, then the monologue is what Job has to say because he doesn't know what else to say. He's silenced his critics. He's put them to shame. They have nothing else to say, but he still doesn't have any answers. And so the monologue, that's where we are right now, is some of the choicest material in the book of Job. Chapter 28 was what? You remember this maybe from a couple of weeks ago? Where is wisdom found? He talks about the mankind who has the ability to go down in caves and overturn mountains and look for gold and silver. And he talks about the wisdom to do those things and then the riches or the resources to buy them. And he says that wisdom, it can't be found, it can't be mined in the ground, and it can't be purchased with a wallet, a check, or a credit card, anything else. And so where is wisdom? And he doesn't tell us other than to say that here is wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And we go, I've heard that before. Of course, what he says there at the end of chapter 28 shows up in the book of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 9 and verse 10, and something related to it in Proverbs chapter 1, and then many other places in the book of Proverbs. And so all of them go back to Job and says, and they basically say, just as Job was searching for wisdom and wondered where it was, he says that this is the pathway or the entrance or the doorway to wisdom. Once I learn to fear God and be desperately concerned about his opinion and know that he's watching me, I will make choices, not necessarily based on the view that I see. I'll make them based on what I know that God sees about my life. So prologue, dialogue, monologue, and the next one doesn't rhyme. I wished it would. In fact, I pulled out a thesaurus, and I worked and I worked and worked and decided there's not going to be a rhyme. There's no more logs here left. So instructions. So just so you notice the difference, the instruction comes from a youthful listener. By the way, if you're here tonight and you're good with words, and you can find me something that matches prologue, dialogue, monologue right here, I'd be willing to pay for that word if you could find it. So the instruction comes from Elihu, and when people look at Elihu, he's considered everything from a genius to a scoundrel. And he certainly is younger, and he is frustrated, and he's been sitting outside of the circle, and he's not been talking, and he answers out of anger. And the anger out of which he answers, some people says, well, it's a righteous indignation because he's heard their foolishness, or no, it's just a stupidity of a young person who flies off the handle. So I'm inclined to say that he does pretty good. So I'm not going to throw him off the bandwagon like some people do, but he'll be interesting. What is interesting about Elihu in his instruction is God never rebukes him. God rebukes the three friends, and in some ways he rebukes Job a little bit along the way, but he never says anything about Elihu. And the fact that he ignores him might mean that he was pretty close, or it might mean that he was way off. So give us some time and we'll know that. So prologue, dialogue, monologue, instruction, and then finally the last section in the book is the Inquisition. And the Inquisition comes to us from a frightening God. God shows up in a storm theophany and begins to speak to Job and his three friends. The first thing that we notice about him, or significant thing, is that God is angry. And he's angry with the three friends. And if you're standing in front of a tornado that's talking to you, and that tornado looks down at you and says, I'm very angry with you. And in fact, if you don't get Job to pray for you, you're dead meat, is essentially what he tells them. That's a bad place to be. And so the works righteousness of the three friends, God does not appreciate that in any sense. But God is going to take Job on a tour, a series of questions, many, many of them, several dozen questions. Where were you and where were you and what do you know about this? Not because God doesn't know or because he thinks that Job ought to know, but to put Job in his place and help him to understand who in the world possesses knowledge, and it frankly is in the end, the only person who is the source of all wisdom is God himself. So there's our overview of the book of Job. I hope that that will help you. We're in the monologue section right here. So we're going to look at 28, and we looked at 28. We'll look at 29 tonight. We'll look at, I think, 30 and 31 next time when we come together. This chapter is a blessing. Job's growth is really interesting. Three or four things here. Job has moved from despair to trust. That's really clear. There are five different times in the passages where he begins to say better and better things about God and his trust in God. Things like, though he slay me, yet will I serve him. And oh, that my words were written in a book. And he talks about there being a mediator. He knows that he's going to stand before God. And he wants to give, he wants to proclaim his innocence, but he believes that God will do right. He moves from hating his birth, chapter 3, to 29, to looking forward to rebirth in God's presence. That's huge. That's a big one. And in fact, in chapter 3, what does he say? I hate the day that I was born. And he says in chapter 3, I wish that I had never been born. Now, that isn't going to sound like the person of chapter 29. Because in 29, he's got his breath back. He's got a few things figured out. And he starts to think, yeah, that was pretty good. And I really enjoyed that, and that was a blessing. And God's presence was with me, and I knew his favor. And in fact, as I was here on the earth, God used me to help the fatherless and the widow and the orphan and the victim and all these different people. So rather than cursing his day, he's at least grateful that he was able to do so many things to bless other people for the sake of God and God's goodness. Thirdly, he moves from wishing he'd never been born to remember the good that God had accomplished through him, which really is what I just said. So Job's monologue, chapter 28, where's wisdom to be found? Chapter 9, the way we were. There's a song like that. A few of you might know that. The way we were is the way it went. This is what he's saying right there in chapter 29. I think there is actually quite a secret in terms of grief and sorrow, that at some point when you go through grief and sorrow at loss, you know, whatever that loss may be, that after time, after bitterness and pain and anger, that you get into a season of joy for what was and can learn to be thankful for that. And I think that's what we should do. Chapter 30, how did things get so bad? And then chapter 31, this is where he ends his monologue, I dared God to act. And it's a fascinating chapter. We'll get there. We'll see how Job basically provokes God. He's poking him in the eye several times. And in fact, God actually does in some ways respond to his request to show up. So here we go. The way it used to be, chapter 29, is the only thing we'll be looking at here for tonight, 15 minutes or so, and then we'll be done. He talks about what God had done in his life, and basically everything that he says in verses 1 through 11 all describe the blessing of God. Now that's great, isn't it? Just, you know, you think of everything you've ever thought about the book of Job and his trials and the anguish, and now he's finally rehearsing God's blessing. That's great. That's significant. That's a wonderful thing. If I'm to learn anything tonight about what we're studying, it is that whatever happens in my life, whatever joy you've ever had, whether you're ill now or you don't have a long future, or whether or not we're on our deathbed, it's important to remember that all of the things that I knew and had were all gifts of God on me that were totally undeserved. And at that point, I think we can have a proper kind of joy. So God's blessing on my life in verses 1 through 11 of the chapter, and then my righteous living. Now, when he's going to describe his righteous living, in the second half of the chapter, and the nobility that he had and the respect that he had in the community, the first thing that I want to guard you against is he's not saying that he's righteous so that God ought to be nice to him. He's not saying that he's righteous so that he can earn some good treatment or fair hearing. What he's saying is that a person who knew God, God's grace was in his life, verses 1 through 11, because God's grace was there, he lived a life that was righteous. That's awesome. And when we see these two put together, God blessed me in tremendous ways, and I lived a life that was righteous. One of the things you're going to see is that this is the pattern for my life. This is how I ought to be living, and this is a wonderful thing I ought to strive for. And as we look at this second section here, my righteous living, this is going to answer the accusations of his three friends. Job, you're a sinner. Then Job, you're really a sinner. And then Job, no, I know for a fact and absolutely certain that you're a sinner. You've been abusing people and you've been bad all the way along. And now finally he's going to say and demonstrate and prove that the false accusations of his friends were just outlandish and they were crazy along the way. So the way it used to be, let's reflect a little bit on his life. These are the 2 points for the evening, by the way. This is all we'll do. If you get lost in the middle, that's what we're talking about. The way it used to be, number one, God's blessing in my life. And he's going to describe everything that happened. And he talks about his life as being a noble blessing, as something that was absolutely wonderful. And it was a result of God's kindness in his life. Notice the things that God did for Job that Job recognizes. He says that God watched over me. Isn't that nice? I mean, it's nice to go from the guy who wishes he were dead and were never born and is very angry at his friends to now thinking, you know, way back then, or in fact, 6 months ago, I do think that he suffered for a while, a couple of seasons, whatever, 6, 8 months, 10 months, a year, that he remembered that all of that time and all of those years and over the birth of all of my children and all that was there, that God's blessing was over me, and if I get nothing else, it's good enough. Number two, He says that God's lamp shined upon me. And I'm going to use the word pronoun him because it's all going to go back to God. His lamp shined upon me. He had a sense of God's joy and God's presence. The Aaronic blessing. When it says, may his face shine upon you, may he give you peace, that's the point. I looked up in the morning and I walked in the field and wherever it was, I sensed the smile of God on my life. Which is what we all ought to do, and you can do. Do you sense that? The smile of God on your life is what he knew was there. He talked about his light and how that light directed me in verses 3 and 4. And then he says that his counsel guided me. Now, did you know all of these things about Job? This is really significant. He was watching over me. His face shined upon me. His light directed me. His counsel guided me. It's no wonder he did so well. It's no wonder he was so successful at everything he did because God was there in a special way in his life. And his presence encouraged me. He used the word his friendship. The friendship of God was there. And all of a sudden, as I look at Job and compare him to his three friends had no relationship with God that was in any sense meaningful. But this is the relationship that Job had. God is watching me. God is with me. God is shining on me. God is smiling at me. His light is directing me. His counsel is guiding me. And his presence encourages me. His blessings upon my life. He says a couple of things about it. And then we'll look at the second point. There's one truth in there right in the middle that we'll look at in a minute. He talks about the joys of his life that came as a result of God's blessing. The first one in chapter 29, verse 5, is that my children were around me. Now, how many children does he have now? Well, he has none, right? They're all gone. But he's looking back over it, and he remembers what a blessing that it was in his life, that his children were there and that they were a part of his life. It was a great thing. So children, right? I've got four of them here. I'm grateful for them. The same thing is true. And if you're a parent, you could say that also. Secondly, the joy of my life. He says, my life was rich with cream, and I translated that as butter. I think that's the idea. One of the ways to say that it was just sweet all the way, like milk and honey, as you see sometimes in the Old Testament. My life was rich, and everything about it seemed rich and good. I was respected at the city gate. And this section right here, if I would have had a little bit more time and had planned more directly, I could have brought you a picture. The picture that I would have brought you of what it means to sit at the city gate. You ought to know this in the Old Testament. To sit in the city gate means to be one of the principal elders, to be one of the senators, to be the judge. When Lot is at Sodom, one of the things we know about Lot is he's sitting in the city gate, meaning that he's been elevated in this pagan and awful society and city to be a judge, probably because he's the only person they could all trust. You know, who could you trust? Well, I can't trust you, and you can't trust me, but we can trust him. And so Job was elevated to that. And we're going to learn something. I meant Lot, by the way. But Job's going to do the same thing here. And you probably have never heard this before about his character. So we'll get there in just a second. Listen to what it says here. These are words I said. Job reveals in this chapter, Job 29, in 7 through 17, that he had been a respected judge. So you think, well, he was an administrator, he was a farmer, you know, he was these things. But now we learn the rest of the story. For the first time, we learn that when people were in need, when there were criminals, when there was something to be adjudicated, they would go to Job. He would sit at the city gate. And I have pictures in some of the ruins of that we looked at when we were in Israel. There would be the city gate right alongside, and people would come in the city. They would talk to the person. Remember what Absalom did, by the way? For 40 years, Absalom came there, and he sat alongside of the city at the city gate. Oh, if you would have let me adjudicate your case, I would have stood up for you. I mean, it sounded like a Democrat. Pardon me for saying that. I shouldn't have said that. But that's basically what Absalom was doing. I'll pay off all your student loans, and I'll do everything that you want me to do. That's what Absalom did when he sat at the city gate. Job, when he sat at the city gate, I said it just for tongue-in-cheek to make the point. When Job sat at the city gate, he wasn't Democrat or Republican, by the way. He was honest. Always did that which was right, not that which made him popular. This is huge to understand this about the person of Job. So here we go. Let's consider Job the noble, righteous judge. If you go home tonight and you say, well, what did we learn tonight in the book of Job? This is the thing I'd like for you to know. That when I read through the book of Job and I'm trying to understand what's going on, when I get to the monologue, I learned that he was really important, that he was a godly man, that he was a judge. In fact, if you hadn't got it before, maybe this will make sense to you. And here's a light that's going to go off. He was the moderator, or he was the goel, or he was the kinsman redeemer. Or as he said, oh, that my redeemer would live. He wanted someone who would stand up in his place and defend him. Remember that? That's all through the book. One of the reasons he wanted someone to defend him and stand up for him is because he'd been doing that all his life. He'd been defending the fatherless and the widow and the orphan and these people. And because he stood up for others in their need, he's going, where is it when it's my turn? Why can't someone do for me on a spiritual level what I have been doing for others on a physical level? It's huge in understanding the book. And so here's what he says about his righteousness. We can just look through them rather quickly and make our point and be done for the night. He says that when he walked into town, the young men hid. And so they looked at him. It would be like standing in the crowd and seeing a presidential candidate or someone of great significance walk in. You would all want to move back and give him some respect. This is what Job received. The old men, they stood. Now, it's fascinating that the old people stood because the young men were required to stand when the old men came into town. But here he's saying that the old men stood when he came into town, showing that he was a man of great nobility, great dignity, one that everyone could trust. The princes were silenced, and so they put their hand over their mouth, the text says, and the nobles were hushed along the way. And here's what he says that he did. He delivered the poor. Now, if you stand before a judge, you simply, and you certainly want a judge who's honest, one who doesn't have two tiers of justice. I keep hearing this about our country these days, and pardon me for being, I'm not going to be any more political, but you keep hearing that there's a different justice system for the rich than there is for the poor. It's probably true that if you're rich enough, you can buy a lawyer, or you can get out of things. What he's saying here is I couldn't be bought. And I wasn't a respecter of persons. And I didn't look at the poor people and disdain them, that I cared for them. I delivered the poor. I helped the orphan. See how it all goes together? I was friend to the perishing, and I was friend to the widow. I ruled in righteousness like a garment. And this is the verse that I mentioned. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. And my justice was like a robe and a turban. Now, clearly, I think that this has implications that are messianic. It reminds us of Jesus and the fact that Jesus was the perfect, is the perfect what? Judge, deliverer, defender. And what Job is saying that he was in his society, you know, his society, wherever he lived at the time, they were really blessed to have someone as noble and great as Job. And I think it does refer and points forward to Christ, but I think it talks about what Job did. When he thought about his life, he'd get up in the morning, and rather than put it on his Carhartts or some other thing, he put on righteousness. That would be his guide. There are multiple verses in the New Testament that tell us, by the way, to do the same thing. Colossians talks about it, putting off and putting on righteousness, the banner of truth, the spiritual weaponry and armor of God, very much related to it. And so here's what we do. He says that I was the sight to the blind, just going down through the list. You can see how it works itself out. I was feet to the lame. I was father to the poor. I was defender of the victim. And when he talks about a victim, he says, I broke the fangs of the enemies. The point is, he says sometimes victims, those who have no one to defend them, they feel like they've been attacked by a lion or a dinosaur or a serpent. And he comes along and he crushes that old serpent and sets them free. And so we're going to describe here for just a second the wisdom that Job developed within the text. He says in verse 21 that I was so wise. Now notice we're back to the theme of wisdom and what it says, that men listened and men waited. I was so wise that men refused to answer back. I was so wise that they drank in my words like the ground drinks in the rain. Just and as I look at those three for just a second, I think there's an application for you. And an application for me, which is our lives ought to be driven by a desire for wisdom and a kind of wisdom that pours from our mouth. You know, it seems like We are so content in everything that we see on television or on the internet. People just pour forth foolishness. And I'm okay with the joke, and you've heard me tell one or two. I don't tell them often because I don't tell them well, right? It's okay to smile along the way. That's not the problem. But why is it that our words have to be so foolish? And what he's saying here is that his wisdom was so wonderful that virtually everything that came out of his mouth was refreshing to those who hear it. That is a pattern for us for living a righteous kind of life. He says that he was chief. Did you notice this? I was chief, I was king, and I was comforter at the end of the chapter, which means that he was like rock solid, the best of all of them. And so just a couple of lessons, and we'll be done for tonight from this wonderful chapter in the monologue of Job. I think it's really great. It is the blessings of our lives all come out of God's goodness. I can never forget that. And if I am forgetting that, I need to be brought back to that. And if I go through a trial and a difficulty and the clouds don't begin to part and I don't know what else to do, at least this ought to be the first thing that I remember again, that all the blessings of my life come from the fact that God has been good to me. Number two, it is a glorious privilege to be used for the good of others. This is what he's saying. I was all of these things, and so what are the poor going to do now? What are the orphans going to do now? What are the blind going to do now? What are the victims going to do now? Job doesn't even have the ability to help them anymore. And though he can help them, I think one of the arguments that could be made from it is you can, and you should, and we ought to be those kind of people that do those kinds of things that Job talked about. And here it is. I think that we need to put our lives together as and righteousness as a garment also along the way. And so in conclusion, when we listen to this last one in his monologue, this is my final point before we go on next week. It's simply this. We would do well to seek to follow the example of Job. And if I could be half as godly as Job was, I'll be twice as godly as I am right now. It really is a tremendous example for us in our lives. So look at your life. When people confuse you with Job, oh, you're acting just like Job. And you would say, well, yeah, because I'm suffering well. But truly, the Job of the Scriptures is the one who cared for others and ministered in absolutely tremendous ways. God help us to follow the example of a truly righteous, godly man. Thank you, Father, for the opportunity to look into the book of Job and get towards these final sections. I'm quite inclined to say that probably most of us have never heard any teaching on Job chapter 28 or 29 in this section here, but the example of your servant blows us away. It is absolutely phenomenal how kind and good and caring and righteous that he is, and that he speaks with wisdom in all that he says. Impact us, Lord, that we would do the same. Thank you. I ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.